Jeremiah chapter 22. I have been persuaded by the Lord to preach today on materialism and what I call godly economics. Our chapter shows good King Josiah's son and grandson, Jehoiakim and Jehoiakim, in a very bad light. Both of them ripe for extinction as kings of Judah. And this, of course, for their complete failure to see the reality of their situation at that time as being under the judgment of God, willful ignorance of which led them to seek to feather their own precarious nests to the exclusion of the true welfare of their people and the will of God. And consideration of this chapter leads us to consider what is godly rule and what is not, what may be legitimate use of material resources by governing authorities, and what is not. The far from evangelical present moderator of our church, James White, has repeatedly criticized Margaret Thatcher for her speech to the General Assembly last May for seeking to justify the creation of wealth, but not, as she said, for its own sake. A former moderator, Tom Torrance, who is an evangelical, has entered the fray in an article in Life and Work, which you may read, implicitly criticizing the Prime Minister's critics for failing to appreciate what he calls her sound theology. Here is how the Prime Minister summed up what she said last May. There is little hope for democracy if the hearts of men and women in democratic societies cannot be touched by a call to something greater than themselves. Political structures, state institutions, collective ideas are not enough. We parliamentarians can legislate for the rule of law. You, the church, said she in assembly, can teach the life of faith. She used the word can when she ought to have said ought to teach and must teach the life of faith. The Prime Minister, of course, didn't say everything, but what she did say surely seems reasonable and sound to Christian people as far as it goes. And yet, the result of 10 years of government, largely by her influence, has led many in the nation to think and feel that a spirit of greed has overtaken us. How far that is true is for each person to judge for themselves. But there is a factor in the present political situation which we must consider. The present political policy, and possibly in its philosophy too, which is exceedingly worrying. Namely, that the national economy is expected to depend mainly, if not entirely, on what is called market forces to determine its economic stance and its prosperity. This, of course, gives freedom to the competitive element in human nature and in business to exercise and exert itself. And it is that which, although it can be morally healthy in a caring community, is full of hazards, human nature being what it is. Since jealousy alone fires people to compete with their fellows and to seek to outdo and excel each other. Indeed, applying the idea of competition to our parliamentary democracy, I have more than once declared here that I think the idea of an official opposition with all the parliamentary clash which that involves is a bad idea in itself, since it invites controversy, conflict, and a competitive spirit which, out of hand, can be the very antithesis communality and comradeship. Surely our common humanity, not to say our Christian profession, calls for cooperation rather than competition. Of course, there is a proper spirit of competition, without which there would be no stimulus to do anything at all. Such a spirit of proper competition is expressed by the writer to the Hebrews when he says, "Let us consider one another to incite or provoke to love and to good works." Let us consider one another to incite or provoke to love and to good works. Hebrews 10:24. Not to outdo one another, or to discountenance or discommode each other, but to put others first, in honor preferring one another. We cannot have too much of that gracious competitive spirit, can we, by which each seeks to excel the other in loving and caring. For, of course, the only possible objection to that is a spirit which breeds selfishness, complacency, and self-centeredness. However, when we hear someone inveighing unctuously, sanctimoniously against selfishness and sounding its death knell, is there not something within our carnal, selfish hearts which fears exceedingly to abandon personal self-interest and well-being? Who is going to look after us if we don't look after ourselves? For a supposed life of threadbare misery and sheer loss of enjoyment in a life which could become a vacuum of emptiness and meaninglessness, no life at all, because we've given away all that makes life worthwhile. They say that the real problem of prison life, especially in remand homes, is boredom and emptiness. But then, as far as Christians are concerned, there is surely no fear of living negatively if we live for others, because there are satisfactions in caring for others which are beyond all the satisfactions of personal indulgence. In fact, it is selfishness which so often leads to one kind of impoverishment, even poverty or another, Whereas the book of Proverbs tells us there is that scatters, that is in generosity. There is that scatters and yet increases. I think that every Christian of any standing at all and any Christian experience should have experienced that. I testify to it, that there is that scatters and yet increases. But have we all learned it, and sufficiently? Of course, how to apply to society in general, communally and politically, what should obtain in Christian fellowship is another matter. Although there are means by which caring people can seek to shoulder some of the burdens of the community, especially in neighbor sharing and caring, community councils, and now parents on school boards, etc., etc. But are we in our Christian communities as sharing and caring of each other as we ought to be? How is it with us? And how is it with you about that? There are those in our fellowship who share their homes and the hospitality of their homes with an astonishing number of people, and often entertain angels unawares. Others simply don't. Some are exceedingly generous with their offerings and gifts, often given by stealth. Others, not. What pots of gold do you or I withhold from the supervision of our caring Lord for his work and his people? Are we as careful before the Lord about that as the Lord expects from those who profess a sustained and vibrant witness to the saving power of the Lord Jesus Christ? Do our deeds of mercy and charity match our profession? And how absolutely generous are we with the gifts God has given us? Now take the matter of usury, interest, dividend, making profit from the loan of our money. You know that usury is forbidden in the Bible. But how may that be viewed with regard to receiving interest on money loaned to one cause or another? How should we regard it? Ronald Wallace, who is Tom Torrance's brother-in-law, expounding John Calvin, says, "It was only in relation to such unproductive loans given for relief and consumption, that is to the poor, that usury was forbidden. Whereas the loan given for production, so that the borrower could profit from its use, was," he says, "another thing. The usury forbidden in the Bible," he says, "is only as to the poor, and consequently, if we have to do with the rich, usury is freely permitted." Thus John Calvin. You see the point? To extort interest, usury, from someone in an unfortunate or unhappy situation is really to take advantage of their plight, like a greedy, grasping, heart heartless moneylender, and to make money out of their plight, which is surely monstrous and the very antithesis of charity and brotherly love. So much for what we do with what we regard as our own money. What about money which we may regard as belonging to the government as a legitimate tax on our income? It would appear that many have scruples about covenanting offerings to enable the government to add something like a third to the amount they give to the Lord for his work. The large majority of you, our congregation, seem determined to have nothing to do with covenanting at all, as the statistics show, even if to do so would add about a third to what the church would receive from them for the Lord's work. What do you think of that? Is it because we do not care that the Lord's work should be adequately financed? Surely not. We know, of course, that the government could withdraw this generous concession at any moment, as local government could with bus ticket concessions. And those churches which largely depend on such support would then be in a bad way. But while the government is willing to grant such a concession to charitable and Christian causes, is it morally reprehensible to accept them? What then about the possible acceptance of £800,000 from the Historic Building Society toward the restoration of our church building to its original condition? That's not quite the same, but is it so different that you have a conscience about the one but not about the other? I have said before that I think the small number of covenants contracted by the members and adherents of this congregation for the Lord's work in general or relative to the spire is miserable and disgraceful. And as to the present state of the spire fund, when we know we shall need £50,000 at least, whatever happens to the spire, restored or taken down. I have said in the Deacon's Court that the low state of the spire fund reflects very badly on the generosity of many in our congregation. And the thing that worries me is this, that many who formerly worshipped with us, or who do so occasionally, or even some who have never done so because they are out of far more generous to Gilcomston, that many who sit under its ministry and have done for years. Why should those who no longer benefit directly from the ministry have to prop us up? I have written a letter for the next record to say that I think it is time for some of our most generous friends beyond Aberdeen and beyond our shores possibly to call a halt to their generosity to us until we ourselves learn to shoulder our own burdens more adequately. Now you would know that I hardly level this at those who do not have the means to support the work more than they do. Some on small incomes might amaze others with the sacrificial generosity of their givings. But those who have the means are hereby challenged. I challenge you. For if you think this work, which is now noised abroad far and wide, the number of visitors from abroad alone, to say nothing of those who come from every part of the land to visit us, proves that. If you think this work is worth continuing, and thousands beyond us think it is, then those who benefit most nearly and directly from it had better support it better than some have done. But you may be grieved at me for speaking like this, but you couldn't be more embarrassed than I am. Wild horses wouldn't have dragged me to do this today if I had not been constrained to do so by the Lord. And those who do not receive what I say as from the Lord are, I believe, in controversy far more with him than with me. And that is a far more serious matter, is it not? Woe to him who builds his palace by unrighteousness, his upper rooms by injustice, making his countrymen work for nothing, not paying them for their labor. He says, I will build myself a great palace with spacious upper rooms. So he makes large windows in it, panels it with cedar, and decorates it with red. Does it make you a king to have more and more cedar? Did your father Josiah have food? Did not your father Josiah have food and drink? He did what was right and just. So all went well with him. He defended the cause of the poor and needy, and so all went well. Then asks the prophet this question: is that not what it means? And he's speaking from the Lord. Is that not what it means to know me? O land, land, land. O Gilcomston, Gilcomston, Gilcomston. Hear the word of the Lord. Amen.